This is Spectator Radio, and you're listening to Life and Arts with Dominic Green for Spectator USA.
Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA, and I'd like to welcome you to our weekly Life and Arts podcast. This week, I'm casting the pod with Matthew Hennessy. He's an Associate Editorial Features Editor at The Wall Street Journal. He's also the author of Zero Hour for Gen X, How the Last Adult Generation Can Save America from Millennials. Matthew Hennessy, welcome to Spectator USA.
It's my pleasure, Dominic.
So first off, the terminology. What is Generation X?
Okay, Generation X is a cohort of Americans born roughly between about 1965 and 1981. And I will stop right there to say that there's not a whole lot of consensus about these dates and that you will frequently get people disputing them. I borrowed that span of years from Pew Research. It works very well for me. I happen to fall right smack in the middle of it since I was born in 1973. So Generation X at the moment is roughly between about 40 years old and 55. Let's just put it that way.
Before them, you have the boomers who were born after the Second World War. And then after Gen X, you have, am I right, the millennials? Or do we also have Gen Y?
Yeah. So I think at the beginning, and by the beginning, I mean the first time I ever heard of the millennials mentioned as a discrete group, I'm pretty sure they were calling them Gen Y. So, you know, in the late 90s, just because there's a lag sometimes in the naming of these generations. So Generation X didn't pick up its name until the early 90s, up until, you know, in the 60s and in the early 70s, they were referred to as the baby bust just to distinguish them from what came before. And so Generation Y, I think, was meant as the kind of logical successor to Generation X, but it very quickly became the millennials, in part because that wonderful, long-forgotten event, the millennium, was approaching. And
I can dimly remember.
Yeah,
this.
There was a lot of talk of the end of the world in the air, and so perhaps there's some hidden meaning to their name, the millennials.
The curious thing is that Generation X originally referred to the boomers in that I believe it goes back to the 1950s. There was a photo essay by Robert Capa on the subject of children born after the war in Europe, and that was entitled Generation X. And then there was a book in the mid-60s in Britain about pop culture called Generation X. And then there was a punk band in England with Billy Idol on vocals called Generation X. All of these things, I think, fall within the category of the boomers. So when did Generation X become the Generation X that we know?
You know, my memory is that there was a book by a Canadian writer, Douglas Copeland.
Oh, yes, I forgot.
Called Generation X Chronicles or something. And that seemed to come out in around the time when everyone started calling us Generation X. And it was meant to convey a mood, I think, of sort of melancholia and a kind of a brooding nature.
So what was happening in America at that point? Because I was in England and we were reading this and watching the film and so on that came out later. And we didn't really understand why everybody was so unhappy. That decade in England was a very hedonistic, fun time. What was going on here?
Well, which decade are you referring to?
The 90s, I think, from what I can remember.
Okay, so the 90s are, you know, like all decades, they have a real interesting topography to them. The beginning of the 90s, in this country anyway, was a period of great hope and ambition for the country. It was a period when, as you know, the dynamics of the global political scene were changing. And it seemed like very momentous, the famous Francis Fukuyama phrase, the end of history. I was 17 years old when the Berlin Wall fell. You know, shortly after that, the Soviet Union collapsed. It was remarkable. It was an amazing thing to live through. And I was very aware that it was an amazing thing. It wasn't something that I missed. I think everyone who was my age was convinced that we were entering this long period of a Pax Americana, where the United States would be, the sole indispensable benevolent power in the world. And it went well for a while until, you know, the end of the decade when it famously, you know, fell apart. But between 1990 and September 11th, 2001, there were a lot of things going on inside the United States, which you may have been aware of, that were quite formative to people like me. And as I lay out in the book, kind of what the cumulative effect of them was to strip my generation of its idealism.
So what happened, in other words? Because your argument is that Generation X is in danger of missing its cue, of not getting onto the stage of history in time.
I picked out a few key events in the 90s that I thought were real markers that can help explain how Generation X came by its particular worldview. The first was the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. which really came as a shock to people like me who were laboring under the impression that much of the hard work of racial reconciliation in this country had been accomplished in the 1960s. After all, that's what the baby boomers told us repeatedly, that they had engaged this glorious struggle and that the original sin of the American founding had been redeemed. We believed that. We listened to rap music. We went to integrated schools. We watched Bill Cosby's wonderful American Family on TV. So to see an American city erupt into flames like it was 1967 or 68 was a shocking thing indeed. And then following very quickly on that was the O.J. Simpson debacle mm-hmm. and the trial of the century, which struck a lot of people as an absolute miscarriage of justice. And so our faith in the justice system was shaken. And then capping it all off was the Clinton impeachment scandal and a general sense that politics was some sort of a mirage and that there would be no redemption through politics. So those three events, followed by the, you know, world-altering moment of September 11th, 2001, I think, which all went down during my 20s, I think combined to create a generation that doesn't have its head in the clouds so much about the possibility of salvation through any of those means, through the justice system, through the political system, through the economic system. Of course, we lived through some pretty rough economic times towards the end of that decade, and who entered their 30s and their adulthood with their head on their shoulder squarely.
I mean, I was thinking the generation of the 1930s was very idealistic and often very wrong-headed, but when it came to it, they got down to it and emerged to what was subsequently called the greatest generation. Your book, you're arguing that your generation, I should say my generation too, having been disabused of its idealism, has not had the opportunity to apply that lesson. Because the generation that's lost its idealism is in many ways in a good position to make a useful contribution. Why is it that Generation X are not getting into positions of command from which they might make a difference?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. The first and the most obvious one is that it's a function of size, our relative size compared to what came before and what comes after. The baby boomers were at the time the largest American generation that had ever been, and they moved through the culture with significant effect. I mean, we don't need to rehearse it all here, but everyone knows the story, and the story's not over. The story continues to unfold, and the wreckage is all around us, and you don't need me to catalog it. So there was something like 75 million baby boomers. There still is something like 70 million baby boomers. They're beginning to die off, but they're not leaving the stage, as it were. They're not leaving their jobs. They're not leaving politics. They're not ceding the field the way you would expect people who are in their late 60s and 70s would be doing. Okay, on top of that, you have the millennial wave, which is coming up behind, which is even larger. And this is a famously impatient and a famously impatient generation that is not looking to wait its turn, that is had been conditioned by technology to expect instantaneous gratification, and is really ready to move into important jobs of power and control now, if you please. And so Generation X is sandwiched in between. We also happen to be in midlife, which is a time of sort of putting your nose to the grindstone and raising your family and sort of getting on with it.
So you're describing really the old generation, the boomers, are still in control of the institutions, And the new generation, the millennials, are in control of the media, in effect, the new digital media. How are Gen X going to gain a foothold in this sort of generational squeeze?
Well, it sounds, you know, the way you've put it and the way I framed it sounds very dramatic. I actually intend it to be quite modest. It's really a matter of exerting ourselves or standing up for things that we believe in. Now, of course, in a group of 60 some odd million people, you're not going to get everyone agreeing on these types of things. But when I speak to my friends, guys like you, people who are my own age, roughly, I do sense a great deal of anxiety about the drift of things, and especially in so much as we're sort of in the thrall of Silicon Valley and our gadgets and our devices and staring at our screens all day. But the main reason I wrote the book was because I could feel myself spiraling out of control with social media and my devices and stuff.
You were actually having a midlife crisis in social media, which I think is a very Gen X experience, as you describe it, because this is a generation that began with pencils and paper in the old way and has then completely overrun by digitization.
Yeah.
And had to adopt it really in midlife.
Yes, it is actually a crisis in the sense that the world that we thought we were going to inherit, the world that we were preparing ourselves for, doesn't really exist anymore. Now, maybe every generation experiences that. Yeah.
Not at the age of 40.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I mean, there's also a general a feeling that I have been wrestling with, which is that the world that is being created, that's being born all around us, isn't really meant for me. It's not really being prepared. The table's not being sent, mm-hmm. set for guys like us. It's being set for and being set by, in many cases, millennials, and who don't necessarily share all of the values. And I use that term advisedly, that people like you and I share. When I say values, I don't mean political values, right and left, Democrat or Republican or anything like that. I mean a sense of looking someone in the eye when you're talking to them, or you know, calling them on the phone instead of texting them, or actually meeting the people that you do business with face to face. Going into an office, looking someone in the eye when you ask them for a date. These are values that we didn't know were important until they started going extinct.
Do you see a connection between the fraying of those kind of small politenesses in everyday life and the current president, who seems also to have dispensed with many of his little politenesses in the way he engages publicly with people?
I suppose there probably is one. You call them small politenesses. I mean, they're obviously very big.
Oh,
they're very important.
They're cumulatively massive. Absolutely. Yeah.
So someone is going to one day win a PhD for figuring out exactly who was the cause and who was the effect here. I know that it's going downhill.
Is it grandpa or is it the grandkids?
Yeah, well, as I say in the book, I suppose we should all be surprised that the rot reached the highest office in the land as quickly as it had. But it's been rotting in our own homes and in our own spheres of influence for the last decade or so. It's only in the last few months, perhaps, that people have started to notice it. I get the sense that while this whole social media revolution is still quite young, we're only just poked our head out for the first time, I think, in 2018 and said, hold on a second, what's going on here? This is all proceeding with very little input from the people. It seems to be unfolding according to a script being written in a secret location in California somewhere.
Donald Trump is presumably going to be the last boomer president.
No, that's not necessarily true.
Oh, no. Do you think there's another one? Who?
Well, for one thing, he'll probably – this is a silly thing. So I shouldn't say this.
Go
but
on.
If I had to bet, he would win re-election.
Oh, yes.
Now, let's say he doesn't. Who's going to challenge him? It could be Joe Biden. It could be Hillary Clinton. All of that is within the realm of possibility. He could get a challenge from a Gen Xer, mm-hmm. from a Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker or something like that. But then what? What happens after that? There's going to be maybe 10 years from now, the oldest millennial is going to be my age. They'll be in their 40s. They'll be getting close to 50.
President Zuckerberg will be lining
up. Yeah, so it'll
job.
Be, you know, Gen X will get maybe one shot at this, you know, and then it'll be all millennials all the time.
That's a harrowing prospect, a permanent future, eternal revolution by the millennials. So apart from that, what do Gen X have to look forward to in the future?
Well, it sounds like what we all have to look forward to is this atrocity called the Internet of Things, whereby your entire home will become an internet-enabled device, and where your car will become an internet-enabled device, and where we will all have to submit to permanent surveillance all the time. Now, I say we'll all have to submit. The fascinating thing about about us is that we've all taken it up willingly. We can't wait to sacrifice our privacy in exchange for a fancy new gadget or a marginal improvement in the way we shop or the way we design our homes or the way we clean our homes. There's even, you know, vacuum cleaners that are spying on us now. So that seems to be the future. No, the call that I'm issuing, if that's not too bombastic, is that we should maybe pump the brakes, that we should express ourselves if we're not interested in having a toaster that's connected to the internet or a refrigerator that talks to our Fitbit and decides that we...
Yeah, I'm not interested in any of that, to be honest. I just want the toast.
So what mechanisms do we have to resist this? I mean, we don't have many. We can moan about it, which is what I do, or we can use the power of our purses, if you like, you know.
Yeah, we can secede in the power of secession.
It takes a lot because the revolution is coming whether you want it or not. I mean, you probably had the experience where you buy a new thing for your home, you replace something that needs to be replaced, and only to find out that it's smarter than the last version, meaning that it wants to talk to other appliances and it wants to talk to the internet and it wants to collect data on you. So part of this is going to be really, really difficult to avoid because it's going to just happen naturally during the natural processes of planned obsolescence. So I'm not entirely optimistic that we're going to be able to turn it back, but you know, if not us, who?
Well, yeah, this is very true, and there is one other question, which is of course completely speculative. You were describing how Generation X was reshaped by a series of experiences, particularly, of course, 9/11 and the Iraq War being crucial to those. It seems to me the millennials haven't yet really had those kind of moments that test the principles they start with and produce a generation in its mature form. Do you think they'll still be as unconcerned, say, about history or social connection in a way as time goes on?
Well, I don't agree totally with your premise there. The millennials, my book is about Generation X, but millennials have certainly had their own ride through history. It's just that it adds up to a different destination or a different sort of set of assumptions about the way the world works than you or I have. They, as a group, report being thoroughly disgusted by the Iraq War, thoroughly disgusted by the Bush administration, what they see as just a ballet of incompetence, the response to Hurricane Katrina. You have to remember these people were, you know, in their teenage years when the housing market collapsed, many of them. So they emerged from the first decade of the 21st century with a thoroughly pessimistic view of almost everything. So they carry into adulthood a kind of a desire to be, you know, the only thing that really works in their lives is their technology. I think that's a broad statement, It's, you know, it's defensible. They look around and they see nothing but chaos except for the stuff that's coming out of Silicon Valley, which is awesome. And I'll be the first to admit it's great. It's made many people's lives much better. But I think that whereas you or I might say, hey, this is great, but I'm giving up an awful lot in exchange for the benefit, most millennials take what Silicon Valley has on offer and say, this is great, give me more, I don't care, I don't, you know, damn right. The torpedoes, damn the cost.
So you're describing, actually, there are some points of overlap between Generation X and the millennials, certainly in a general sense of disappointment with the direction things have gone. What differs is the attitude to technology, which is obviously a form of government as it's developing, it's forming a controlling force in our lives. What do you think the chances are of Generation X emerging as a bridge, in a way, of restoring some kind of connection between the generations, which is something which was broken famously in the late 60s?
Well, I'm not optimistic.
Oh.
You know, and I'm probably guilty of contributing to the, you know, the animus between the generations somewhat. I haven't heard too many millennials telling me that I'm that I'm helping. So I understand that.
They haven't chased you out of a restaurant yet.
No, that's not happened, thank God. I'm kind of invisible in that way, so but it could happen. I certainly have been swarmed on Twitter.
Well, we could chase you down on Twitter. Yeah, yeah, we can make this happen. We can put it on
Twitter.
Oh,
no, that's happened already. It's an alarming thing. But, you know, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal not that long ago about the next generation coming up after that, and they've got various names, iGen, Generation Z. You know, these are kids who are in their teens, and you know, what I can do really in my life to affect change is to raise my children, right? So this revolution, to some extent, has to start in the home. And so what I've been trying to do with my own kids and, you know, anyone who cares for my advice, I offer it freely, is to, you know, do the sensible thing, which is to monitor and limit their exposure to this technology to the extent possible. Give them a free range childhood, the kind of childhood that we all used to take for granted, but which now you have to really arrange with some intention. That's what I do. I mean, it's possible that in 5, 10, or 15 years, we may all look back and say, gosh, when we first got all these devices and these social media accounts, we all sort of went nuts. We lost our minds for a while, and thank goodness old Hennessy was there to tie us down to earth, because we were in need of a correction. I mean, that could happen, you know, with the leaving out the part where Hennessy gets the credit. But, I mean, it's possible that we just think this was a blip, you know, and I hope that might be the best that we could hope for. We're going to live with these devices in this new world probably forever. There's no putting the genie back in the bottle, but we might be able to regulate ourselves a little more sensibly.
Well, as you say, and there's a lovely line, do not go quietly into the good night of millennial domination, whether in your professional or personal life. And I think that's spot on. I would like to say to people who are listening to this podcast that they should unplug themselves from all of their devices, but only, of course, once they've finished listening. Matthew Hennessy, thank you so much.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure, Dominic.
My name's Dominic Green. I'm Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA, and this week I've been casting the pod with Matthew Hennessy, author of Zero Hour for Gen X, How the Last Adult Generation Can Save America from Millennials, which is out now with Encounter Books. Join us next week for our next Life and Arts podcast. Till then, thank you for listening. Goodbye.